afternoon. So last time we talked a bit about more about how sort of ELF files work. And I guess I have something I didn't write down. We talked about that I should have put on this last time slide. And mentioned that we could have ELF files that are position independent or not position independent. And they both use the same format. It's just whether some addresses are meaningful. And we also talked a bit about sort of dynamic linking in direction. Direction, we had this global offset table, which maybe isn't a great name, but which has sort of pointers to the library functions. And this is used to call the functions instead of actually modifying the individual call instructions for dynamic linking, which has the advantage that we don't have to load the code from the executable and then modify a whole bunch of places in it. Instead, all the modifications are in a separate region, and most of the stuff we just keep exactly as on disk. Then we talked a bit about x86-64 encoding. So we have this kind of general format where we have an opcode, we have this byte that represents a mode and basically two register numbers, but this is also used to represent memory references, and there's a particular format for that. And there's a table you have to look up, and the table varies depending exactly which x86 version. Sometimes we have an extra byte because there wasn't enough room in that one byte. And then we have any constants for the instruction. And we saw an example that in addition to these opcode, we can have a prefix. We saw the example of the rex prefix. So we mentioned that the way they added 8 extra registers to 64-bit x86 is they didn't modify the instruction encodings. They added a byte before each instruction that has the extra bit of each of the register numbers, and also indicates whether the instruction operates on 64 versus 32-bit values. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so we'll look a bit more at x86-64 encoding and addressing. So mentioned sort of very briefly that we had this rex prefix the last time. You know, that has our sort of extra information for an instruction. So let's sort of apply that to an example. So here, this 32-bit add instruction is encoded as 01, which is our opcode. And C1 is the encoding of the mode, reg, and r/m for the case of this instruction. And my question is, if we modify this, so instead of ECX, we have the R10D. What is our new encoding? And the format it's going to have is we're going to have this rex prefix, and we're going to have the same format, but with one of the registers being different. So, someone tell me, what should go in our rex prefix? What should that look like? No volunteers. Okay, so this rex prefix, I'm writing out, this is the bits of it from least most significant to least significant. So our most significant bits are this 0100. Then we have W, R, S, and B. And W is going to syndicate, does this instruction access 64-bit values? And EAX is a 32-bit register. R10D is a 32-bit register. So that's going to be 0. Then our R is the extra bit for this field. So we want to extend from having 3-bit register numbers to 4-bit register numbers. And the register number we want to specify is going to be still all zeros because it's still EAX. So this is zero, this is still EAX, number zero. Then I have an extra bit for the register field and an SIB byte. There's none of those, so we'll just leave that as zero. This is unused. And then I have an extra bit for the R/M, or the SIB base field. In this case, our original sort of template instruction here, we've specified this full register number is basically, you know, 001 for ECX. But what we want is R10D, which is going to be 10. This is 1010 in binary. And this upper bit here, that's where that B comes, B is. So that's going to be our 1. And these lower bits are going to replace that 001 as our that register field. So we end up with the rex prefix being this 1 byte, which if I write this as hex, 0100 is a 4. And this is a 1. So we have 41. The opcode is unchanged. And then we have our new mod RM byte, where the mode is the same. This register part is the same. But this, remember, we changed to this 010. So this byte is going to be our hex encoding of 11000010. If I write this sort of as hex for convenience, this is, here is a C, I hope, and this is a 2. So that gets our encode. Questions on how I went through that? And I'm going through this explicitly because how the rex prefixes work is not super intuitive. Because it's definitely like not how you design a new instruction set. Yeah.
So is the rex prefix added on after like when they transition from 32-bit to 64-bit?
Question, what's the rex prefix added on when they transition from 32 to 64-bit? Yes. So basically the AMD designers said, we want to use all the same encoding logic, but oh, we want these extra bits. We're just going to put them in this prefix. As we'll talk a little bit about, there's other prefixes that x86 already supported at the time, so they already needed to support this idea of instruction prefixes. Yeah?
And so I understand how you got the 1010, that's representing register 10, right? And the highest order bit is going to the B value, but where does the 010 go again?
Where's the 010? That goes in the RM part of the mod RM bit. So that is, specifically, that's here in what became C2.
Okay, and then where does the 41 that you got from the REX prefix?
That goes, that is the REX prefix.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The 41 is the REX prefix, yeah. So 4 something is a REX prefix, generally, if you're looking at sort of the hex version of a x86 machine code. Other questions? Okay, and as another example, if I want to just take this 32-bit instruction and make it a 64-bit instruction, I'm going to have a rex prefix of 1 for W and everything else. I'm not changing. I'm just adding a 0 to the register number, which won't change anything. And so this ends up being 4801C1. I mentioned rex prefixes are one of many instruction prefixes that go in this part of the encoding. So we saw the rex one. There's also this vex prefix, which is how all the instructions that use the XMM and YMM registers use that prefix to indicate that. There's also a prefix for going to 16-bit operands for instructions that default to 32. There is a prefix for synchronization that you'll see that can be added onto a bunch of instructions. We saw that rep idea. The way that's encoded is as an instruction prefix. So we have a normal instruction, we add this prefix to it. There's not a separate rep instruction. And also segment overrides. So we mentioned that we could do like move FS something. This FS part is encoded as a prefix to a normal, otherwise normal move instruction. That says this move instruction uses FS instead of DS, or this next instruction. So to give some examples of other cases, so push RAX, if you look up in the manual for Intel, it says it's encoded as 50 plus the destination register identifier. So in this case, push RAX, RAX is register number 0 in the tables, so it's 50. If we do push R13, we need a rex prefix to indicate the next bit of that register number, so that to have that 1 that for the 13. And our register number is split, and we get 41 for that rex prefix and 55 for the opcode of the push and the last lower 3 bits of the register number. And this example is probably for, but this like gives an example you can look at if you went to like through this, is that here I have, this is opcode 03, and then we have /r represents a mod or mbit, and it tells us the destination here is the register part of the mod or mbit, and the source here is the r/m part of the mod or mbit if it was a register source, or that would be where it goes, otherwise it's just the memory part. And we just look up in the table. We find out we have to encode this with the SIB byte. So I use the table entry that corresponds to using ECX for, well, I use ECX for reg, and I use the table entry for mod and RM that corresponds to using the SIB byte plus a 32-bit displacement. And then I set our scale to 0, 1, which is the number for shift by 1, so 2. My index to 0, 1, 1, which is what RBX is in the table. And my base to 0, 0, 0, which is what RAX is in the table. And then I add my constant in little n. Questions on this encoding process? And if we wanted to modify this to use the upper registers, we'd add a rex prefix. So this example is the same, except I have R10 and R11. And to encode them, I add this rex prefix byte where I have the upper bit of those register numbers. Since they're not zero, I need to add that. And also I need to add this rex prefix to indicate that this is a 64-bit instruction and not a 32-bit one. So, and I mentioned, like, the moves are encoded with a segment override. So, have an example of that here. You can look it up. So, we've gone through enough of the encoding that if you need to encode something by hand, you can do it. Most of the time, you should just use the assembler, but this is mostly useful because we want to reason about code that manipulates code. So a lot of the ways we'll talk about viruses, and viruses need to like modify executables, so they need to have some understanding of encoding. And also we're going to talk about injecting code in programs, and we need to understand when that what that machine code is going to look like, when is it going to work, when is it not. And so one thing, so some things that are kind of more directly relevant to that idea is, so one thing is that there's some things that just cannot be encoded. So the most notable example is that we saw that pretty much all the instructions we cared about use 32-bit offsets, displacements, immediates, even if we were dealing with 64-bit registers. So this means that, for example, this instruction just doesn't exist. It doesn't have an encoding because that displacement is too big. As a special case, there are instructions that take 64-bit immediate values that use RAX. Otherwise, you have to do some math. Also, there are push and pop in 64-bit mode. There's no 32-bit version of them. They're 64-bit or 16-bit. There's nothing in between. And if you look at those tables carefully, there's actually some combination of registers that don't work. So for example, this move instruction does not exist because there's no way to use RSP as the index register. And in normal code, it doesn't come up because you aren't going to use RSP times something to access a value. But you know, it's kind of a non-intuitive thing about just something that doesn't exist. So questions about our impossibilities? And the first one about like not allowing 64-bit constants, that's probably the one that comes up most when we're trying to like actually manipulate or write assembly. So, you know, if you want to set a memory address that's over 32 bits, you're going to have to do something a little less straightforward than you might like. So the other thing that's going to come up is that when we have these constants, sometimes these constants in our instructions represent an address, and sometimes they represent that address as an absolute value, and sometimes they represent that as a relative value. And you have to look up what the case is, but generally, so this move here, this encodes the address of the label as a 32-bit value, versus this move here, which encodes the address of the label as the difference between the location of the current instruction and the label. And this has implications for, can we load this to different parts of memory? Can we move this code around? And in particular, we're going to next talk about viruses, and it's very relevant to viruses if your code is using the first type of instructions or the second. Because if your viruses insert their code in other programs, it's going to be at some random location. That's a big difference as far as whether it will work. And if you do have code using either of these and you want to change the address, you definitely need to know this. And that's something often also viruses will do, is they'll try to change that address. They'll like to match where they actually put some code. Especially for the second case of like a jump. And I'll say that most of our kind of normal jumps, this is, remember, an indirect jump. A normal jump, you know, jump z less than, you know, conditional jump are relative as our calls. So most normal jumps and calls to like where you just do jump label or call label are relative. And I probably should have had that in the slide. But so J label, I guess you do jump label, just a plain jump label, a plain call label is label minus RIP in encoding. Either in like 8 or 32 bits, depending on the case. And so to think about this, let's say we have a virus, it's inserting some code, at some address in an executable's memory. Which of these do we want an absolute encoding for? But do we not want to do that relative to RIP thing? Give a minute to look over. And this, incidentally, is very related to the last question on the quiz that's due Monday. Right, so this question's more subjective because there's something we could do to adjust for either of these cases. So let's start with A. So who thinks we want an absolute encoding for A? Okay. Who thinks we want an absolute encoding for B? Who thinks we want an absolute encoding for C? Who thinks we want an absolute encoding for D? Okay. And so your notion, I think I agree, is that what ideally we do is we just have the code we're inserting as a fixed chunk, and if we use relative addressing for the references to the evil code in the fixed chunk, that means that we don't need to do any logic to process that, as we'll see. We can just copy it blindly. For the references to stuff in the executable we're using, if we use absolute addresses, we just compute the address, override the 32-bit immediate value that points to it, hope the executable's loaded in the bottom 32 bits of memory, and that will work. If it has relative addresses, this would probably handle the executable not being loaded in the bottom 32 bits of memory, bottom 2 to the 31 bits, I should say. But we need to do some computation for each of the references to fix those up, where we can't just figure out what the address is, we need to figure out what the difference between that address and where we're putting this code is, which is doable. It's just, a little more details. So I would say A and D, so I would say that B and C, we definitely don't want absolute encoding. And A and D, it's probably more convenient to have absolute encoding, but not necessarily the most. Now, something you might realize is that, so the difficulty with absolute encoding for A and D is that, if we have a 64-bit address, especially, it's kind of hard to represent. But we could work around that. So for A, we have the challenge that the normal jump instruction uses a relative encoding. But we could kind of work around that by doing, I see what I did. Okay, we could work around that by doing something like, move some value into RAX, and then jump based on RAX. So we could work around that with some, writing some assembly that does things a little less directly. And also this could work around the limit on 32-bit addresses because we can use a 64-bit version of move, the one that exists for RAX. And the same is true for the address of a string in an executable, right? We don't have to use, we can use, a version that allows us whatever size address we want. questions on this issue here. Okay, so we're gonna look at, as kind of our next big topic, probably next week, sort of some examples of how viruses work, and we'll see, like, one thing they have to be concerned about is fixing up these values in their code to move it around. And, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning of the class, like, viruses aren't very common today, but the same kinds of techniques viruses used to be kind of stealthy also apply to non-virus programs. Manipulating machine code is a common thing to do because if your machine code changes, it's much harder to detect, you know, what your malware program. So in the remaining time here, probably the remaining time, we'll see how far we get. We're going to talk a bit about some reverse engineering tools and some issues related to that. And I have the reverse engineering two homework posted. It's marked as tentative. Assuming I get to everything I expect to get to, I'll mark it as not tentative after this. The purpose of that homework is to mainly to have you use a tool like Cahedra or some other similar tool and have experience with it. I'm a little worried that the difficulty might be wrong. And I'm worried in both directions, so, like, it might be too easy or too hard. It's all new, so I don't know. But the main goal is, like, is that meant not to be very hard, but to, like, be something that's sort of a good example of what these reverse engineering tools that are more sophisticated than just using object dump can and can't do. And to talk kind of about general kind of reverse engineering things, I'll first talk about some tools that are much more basic than Cahedra. And then go into sort of, my example will be Cahedra, but there's other tools like Cahedra out there. I'm gonna recommend Cahedra because it's open source, pretty capable. And because it's open source, commercial licenses for it aren't a thing, unlike most of the computing tools where a typical price for commercial use is like $1,000 to $10,000 per year per seat. Their educational licenses are like much free or cheap, but if there's an open source tool, I prefer to, teach that. So as a running example, let's say I have this mystery executable here that I don't know anything about. So the first thing I might do is on Unix, I might run this file command. And it tells me, oh, this is a 64-bit LSB, so little endian, least significant bit, position-independent executable, PIE, executable. They are doing the ATM machine thing for x86-64. It's labeled as version 1 in the ELF file, which is what Linux happens to use. It's dynamically linked. It has an interpreter. We mentioned the interpreter is the thing that actually it gets loaded to do the dynamic linking stuff. And we have some other information. They have a build ID generated by the compiler. And it's mentioned that it's stripped, meaning that it doesn't have any function names in it, which is probably not going to be great. So you might say, how is the file command doing this? Is probably a worthwhile sort of interlude to have. So if you look up the manual page for file, it says it determines the file type. And what is it doing? It looks for quote-unquote magic numbers near the beginning of the file data. So most file formats have a particular thing they put near the beginning. For ELF, if you try to look at them in a text editor, you'll see like there's a funny character in ELF. That's sort of a magic value that indicates this is probably an ELF file. Could you have another file with those bytes? Yeah, but you probably don't. And basically, file has this big database. And here's kind of the format of the uncompiled database, indicating sort of what files look like. So you can see here, it says, oh, if we see at offset 0 this special thing, say it's ELF. If we see later a 2, 4 bytes later, say it's 64-bit. If we see after that, of 1 or a 2, say LSB or SysB. So like we see that information that's printed out, there's just a list of look for this byte at this location, if so, print out this type. And there's just a big database that has been manually compiled that handles a lot of file formats that none of us know about. Okay, so that's a good first thing to know about the executable. You might say, well, it's an executable. We could try to look at the code, but let's start with something simpler. Let's look just at the data. And there's some like human readable text in here. So just running a command that outputs hex and ASCII. And we could like try to figure out what's going on by just scanning through this hex dump and seeing, oh, there's probably some interesting strings in there. But we can automate that process. And I'm going to show you a utility which does this, but how would you write a utility that looks for interesting strings in the file? What should it do? Yeah. So you want to look for bytes in a certain range, in certain range, and then a null. And what's our certain range?
Whatever the minimum.
Okay. So greater than or equal to minimum printable character. Okay. Any other ideas or modifications? Yeah?
Use some kind of dictionary.
Okay, so we could have look for dictionary words. Yeah. Other? Yes. Okay, so there's other things these are some pretty good ideas. There's some other things we might think of later that are more specific to executables. So this first strategy, where probably bytes in certain range is actually printable characters, because there's, you know, just like we have a list of the ASCII characters, you look for the ones that like output as normal stuff and not as junk characters. And there's a program that's pretty standard on most Unix systems called strings that just does that. And it looks for those, and it has an additional constraint. It looks for them to be a certain length. I don't know if it requires the null character terminator, but it's doing that sort of heuristics. And if we look through the output of strings, we see some interesting things here that might give us a hint about what this mystery executable is. There's a save game string. That's a hint. Identify object, that's a hint. We can also ask strings to filter by string length to a much higher threshold. So I just asked for strings over 40 bytes, and that gives us a lot of real hints about what this program might be. And if you're looking at a real program, this sort of thing is probably the first step you'll take. And when we talk about things malware does to avoid analysis, hiding their strings is often something they will be very deliberate about for this reason, because this is so easy to do. But we can kind of infer kind of a bunch of things about that this is a game, some things in the game, that it involves dungeons, that it runs in a terminal window, things we've learned without looking at any code. Questions? Okay. So as I mentioned, we're going to look at some dedicated reverse engineering tools. I'm going to use the running example of Dahedra. Probably the other two most notable ones, there's some more, is Binary Ninja and IDA Pro. Binary Ninja has a free version, at least for educational or non-commercial use, and IDA Pro I think is similar, but you know, for their full version is very expensive for those. And my impression is that it's kind of people who do this professionally, IDA Pro is probably the most common, and it's definitely one of the older ones. And it's kind of variable whether a particular program is better or worse, depending on what you're doing. And Ghidra also has a tool that does this. So in Ghidra, I make a new project. I'm not going to go through this stuff because there's tutorials and it's pretty boring. Load my mystery file and select window, define strings, and I get this list. So it does that too. That's one way we can look at programs, if you're looking for strings. Another analysis we can do quickly is that this is a dynamically linked executable. I can just look at what libraries it uses, and that also gives me a bunch of hints about what's going on. So I can see it uses this libncurses and libtinfo. And I'm guessing most people here don't just know what ncurses is, because you've been coding in the 2010s and not the 1990s. But we can look that up. That sure tells us something about what this program is doing. We can look up tinfo and find out, low level for terminal handling, so that's what it has libraries for. And I look up tinfo by, I went to Debian, a Linux distribution, and just looked up the name of that SO file and figured out what package is it in. Because I knew it was probably a standard Linux thing, given that this was a Linux executable. We can also look for library calls. So I ask for the dynamic symbols. I get a list of all the library calls that this program makes. You know, you might look for them and find that some of these are a bit weird to find in a game. That might like direct you immediately to maybe interesting parts of the program. I can also like do the same sort of thing in Ghidra. So Ghidra has a symbol tree window, and that also shows us a list of kind of the library calls sorted and let us look things up, as we'll see later. You can also look for the usage of the library call, so I can do this manually, or as we'll see, Ghidra will have a slightly more efficient way. So I can say, I saw set UID was used. How is it used? Oh, we call get UID and then call set UID with that result. You see, we have a call to get UID, move it to EDI, the register for set UID and call set UID. So I have this disassembly here, and this is probably my first time showing us disassembly where we, might not have all the symbols. I'd like to talk about some issues with how disassembly works that are, going to be one reason why we want to look at what these sort of reverse engineering helping tools are doing. So here I have this simple example here where I run a printhello function. The printhello function calls puts, and it jumps to puts so it doesn't have to return, so puts returns for it. And when I disassemble this in object dump, you can see that object dump gets a little confused, because I have this string in the middle of my machine code, which is usually not something that the compiler will do, but I can certainly do it. And object dump is just trying to treat this as instructions. And it's like, okay, there's this 4.8. That's a rex prefix, but the rule is that the rex prefix has to go right before the instruction, and it's not. So it just writes rex.w, because that's the best it can make of what's going on there. And then it sees the 6.5, that's the E, and a 6C, that's the L, and says, okay, that's the encoding of INSB. That's a weird, I think a string IO instruction. Like, this is not meaningful instructions, but it tries to decode it as it, because object dumps disassembler, how does it work? It disassembles one instruction, then it looks for the next one, and the next one. Even though that this stuff is never reachable as instructions. But object dump doesn't do the analysis to figure it out. But, you know, fortunately, you know, it knows that print hello is the beginning of a function because there's a symbol there, and it disassembles that properly. But if I get rid of symbols from this executable, object dump gets confused. And basically what happens is that here's the beginning of print hello, and object dump's just going through, starting with main, or starting from the beginning, disassembling things. And it doesn't know to figure out that that's the start of a function. It thinks it's in the middle of another instruction. And we just get junk for a lot of our code here. So how could we fix this? If you're writing a tool like object dump, and hint, Dahedra does this, and all the other tools I mentioned, Binary Ninja, IDA Pro, do the thing where they disassemble this correctly. How do you make that happen? Yeah? So looking at the context, what do we, can you be more specific?
Like looking ahead a little bit instead of just going one instruction at a time.
So looking ahead a little bit. So what did that mean in this case?
Maybe like going a little bit farther than the hello string to understand that maybe that machine code doesn't make sense.
Okay, so you might say going further, so we can figure out the machine code doesn't make sense here. So what do you want to do after that?
Like consider the option that it could be a string.
Consider that it could be a string. So you're saying that your heuristic is when I see some machine code that doesn't make sense, look for a null terminator. I think that would handle this case, yeah. But maybe wouldn't handle, so that would handle this case. And as sort of things that could go wrong with that, I propose sort of an alternate bad scenario of, let's say instead of having a string I was printing out, I had a big number. So there's, so you handle the string case. There's some other things where we might have data mixed in where that wouldn't work so well. Yeah.
Well, since we see at the beginning,
Yeah, so another strategy we can use, we can say, oh, this call goes, we know the address the call goes to. We can just say, an instruction must start there. Let's ignore whatever's going on and say an instruction starts there. And this is basically the strategy Dahedra uses. And this is more complicated than what your proposal is, just assume it's a string. But the reason why Dahedra does the more complicated thing is not just reliability, but it's that, well, Dahedra also wants to get you a list of functions anyways. So we kind of have to do this extra work anyways. And this is not kind of the only tricky case for finding functions. So that's something we're going to want to do for analyzing a program, is generally figuring out where these functions are. That's a useful thing to have. And this is one case where to find the function, we couldn't rely on there being a symbol pointing there. We had to instead look for something else. There's some other cases that are tricky. So if we have something that looks like object-oriented code, it's pretty common to have a table of functions in there and use that table of function pointers to call it. So we need to look for the function pointers. This would be commonly used to implement like inheritance, where you call a function, like you call like draw, and it depends on what tech class you have, what actually gets run. If we look at the startup code on Linux, the way it works is it calls a libc start main function with a pointer to main. So if we want to find main in this way, we have to actually have this heuristic that if we see an address being loaded, it might be a function. That's something Dihedra and the like will do. We also have the issue that we could have tables that are kind of less direct to identify code or functions. So for example, this code, it looks a little contrived. I'm loading the address of an entry of this table, adding an index times 4 to RAX, and that gets me the address of case 1 or case 2, depending on what RDI is, and then I'm jumping there. So, and this code pattern, though, is one of the things GCC will generate for a switch statement. So if you want to disassemble the switch statement correctly, you need to, you know, have some heuristic that deals with this. And similarly, we could just do something stupid, you know. And this seems like stupid code, and it is. But if you're writing malware and you don't want people disassembling it, maybe you do that. Just, you know, deliberately not encode your function addresses in weird ways. This one, you know, we can figure out. We could, like, make it worse by, like, doing something arbitrarily complicated to get our, you know, actual address. Oh, I should do, this is not, oh yeah, so here. Some questions. Yes. So Dihedra mostly kind of figures this stuff out for us. And so this is Dihedra's listing view. And another thing Dihedra figures out, because it's looking at all these references just to find functions and the like, is that it marks cross-references. So here, I have my printHello function, which doesn't have a name, but Dihedra knows it's a function because it's called. And it also tells me, oh, this is called at this address. And it has these cross-references for everything. This is something you could do by hand. And it's really more useful when we have like a big executable. So if I go back to my original mystery program, that's apparently some game, we can find some functions in there that are used in a lot of places. And we have a convenient list of everywhere if we want to inspect that. Another thing Dihedra is doing here is it also is identifying where certain offsets from the stack are used. So when you did RE1, like you had, I guess you didn't have things that are many things on the stack, but sometimes you have things on the stack, they're referenced multiple places. It like just does that analysis. So you can easily find where is this value from the stack used in this function. It tells you all the addresses of that. And it also does the same analysis for like global variables. And so this is just, you know, you could do this by hand, but sure is convenient to have a tool that's just done the tabulating already. And another thing that we could do is we saw that when it sort of found all these functions and so on and variables, it gave them these placeholder names. You can change those. So that's, you know, pretty, so that's sort of what probably a typical actual reverse engineering workflow is. You can like refine the code to look better. And I am not where I expected to be on time. So I will just talk about the other magical feature of programs like Dihedra, Binary Ninja. They have a decompiler. So I kind of undersold the analysis of assembly they're doing. So they basically convert the assembly into code, compile that code back to C. And it mostly works. And in this decompile, we see we have these placeholder variable names. You can just change those and it will update everywhere correctly. So we'll talk a little more about this next time and then get into how viruses work.